everyone.
Hey guys, welcome back.
This is episode 32 of
Literally Disturbed.
My name is Katie.
And I'm Brittany.
And yeah. So we're just going to get right into our stories. I know it's weird. We usually don't do that, but we got a lot going on today. So Brittany, do you want to get into your second half of your story?
Yes, this is for those of you who are for some reason just now listening to this episode first before anything else. This is part two of the great train heist. So go listen to part one first. Yeah. All right. So where we left off was when people were getting captured.
Oh, right. Because they were dum-dums and got themselves captured.
Big dodos in there. What kind of suits were they? I feel like this was, I don't know. Whatever it was, it wasn't Scuba Steve suits. I remember that. Oh, my gosh. The trial of the robbers began at Aylesbury Assizes in Buckinghamshire on January 20th of 1964. Because it would be necessary to accommodate a large number of lawyers and journalists, the existing court was deemed too small, so the offices of Aylesbury Rural District Council were specially converted for the event. The defendants were brought to the court each day from Aylesbury Prison in a compartmentalized van out of the view of the large crowd of spectators. Mr. Justice Edmund Davies presided.
Mr. Justice, sorry. That sounds like some freaking Justice League shit.
It does. That's
Captain
funny.
America, Mr. Justice. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Keep going.
They're here to save the day.
Yep.
To solve the train heist
crime,
mystery, whatever. Anyways, okay. So, Mr. Justice Edmund Davies presided over the trial, which lasted 51 days. And included 613 exhibits.
Damn, imagine being a juror on that.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be interesting, but that's a long
time.
That's
a lot. Listen to this, though. And 240 witnesses.
Damn. I mean, yeah.
All the people involved on the train and everything. Yeah, but still, it's a lot.
But you'd think it'd be so cut and dry. Like, it would just be like, there's so many witnesses and stuff.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, anyways. Yeah.
So I guess the jury went to Grange Youth Center in Aylesbury to like discuss the verdict.
Okay.
So on February 11th of 1964, there was a sensation when John Daly was found to have no case to answer. His counsel, Walter Rayburn, claimed that the evidence against his client was limited to fingerprints being on the Monopoly set found at Leatherslade Farm. And the fact that he went underground after the robbery.
So wait, they found his fingerprint on a Monopoly game?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep, and that's their evidence against him.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. That is kind I wonder of what piece he chose.
Me too. I always like the hat, I think.
I don't remember. I know there's a thimble.
Yep. Maybe that's what it is, the thimble.
I always got stuck with a thimble.
I always got too.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why that's the only one I can remember.
Because it looks like a hat. Yeah. No, I do think there is a top hat. I could be wrong, though.
But I feel like a top hat and a thimble. Our little kid brains just turned it into a hat. Because it's like, what the fuck's a thimble for? Oh, and we said we weren't going to derail.
I know, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. That's just us. Okay, so he went on to say that Doyley had played the Monopoly game with his brother-in-law, Bruce Reynolds, earlier in 1963. And that he'd only gone underground because he was associated with the people that were publicly sought by the police. So there was no proof of his involvement in this conspiracy. The judge agreed and the jury was directed to acquit him. So, Mr. Doyley...
Free bird. Okay. That's such a cute name, Mr. Doyley.
Mr. Doyley, that is cute. So then, Detective Inspector Frank Williams was shocked when this occurred because owing to Tommy Butler's refusal to share information, he had no knowledge of the fact that Daly's prints were only on the Monopoly set. So I feel like that was a blurb because you should probably know where all the sets of fingerprints are if you're going to use that as evidence in a trial. If Williams had known this, he could have asked Doyley questions about the Monopoly set and robbed him of his very effective alibi. You know, or that could have been true.
But who knows?
But who knows, right?
Because were you there? I wasn't.
Okay. So Daly was clever. Daly. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Okay. So when I made, when I printed this story, it originally was 20 pages long. And, you know,
I got onto her.
That was bad. So I changed the font to very small font. I can barely fucking read it. Anyways, all right. So Mr. Daly was clever in avoiding having a photo taken while he was arrested until he could shave his beard. This meant that there was no photo to show the lengths he had gone in order to change his appearance. No action was taken against Butler for his mistake in not ensuring the case against Daly was more thorough. On April 15th of 1964, the proceedings ended with a judge describing the robbery as a crime of sordid violence inspired by vast greed, and passing the sentences of 30 years imprisonment on seven of the robbers. Sentencing. The 11 men sentenced all felt aggrieved at these sentences handed down, especially Bill Bull. I can't say that word. Who actually died in prison. And Lenny Field, who were later found not guilty of the charges against them.
Oh.
Yeah. The other men, aside from Weider, resented what they considered to be the excessive length of the sentences, which were longer than those given to many murderers or armed robbers. Train robbers who were sentenced later by different judges received shorter terms. The severity of the sentences caused some surprise. When mastermind Bruce Reynolds was arrested in 1968, he allegedly told arresting officer Tommy Butler that those sentences had a detrimental effect. According to him, they had plummeted criminals generally to take guns with them when they set out into robberies. Because if you remember, they didn't have any guns.
Mm-hmm.
So that backfired.
Not really, because they didn't have guns.
Well, but...
Sorry.
That's funny.
Sorry.
But, you know, like... Now that you have harsher sentences, you're going to want to make sure you're getting away. And if you got to kill people to make sure there's no witnesses.
True that, but you can't kill all 200 and what, 50?
No, but you can kill all the people that come in contact with you so they don't know, you can't tell who you are.
Yeah.
And if they would, like, I get, okay, listen, don't go robbing trains, duh, that's silly. But, but I don't feel like... You should serve a life sentence in prison when most of the time murders don't even do that.
I feel like because it was nonviolent, they didn't go in there with the intent to shoot anybody, obviously, by not bringing guns. They just wanted the loot.
They just wanted the money.
They shouldn't have, I mean, yes, they shouldn't have robbed the train, but they shouldn't have gotten that harsh of a sentence, in my opinion.
Right. And they should have obviously had to pay back everything.
Yes.
But not like
hell,
with
I know
their
people,
entire life.
I know somebody that... probably shouldn't say this, but I know of someone that embezzled lots of money from their company and they just got a few months in jail and had to pay it back.
A slap on the fucking wrist is what it was.
And they got to have their Orange is the New Black kind of
story to tell people. Like,
well, it wasn't true, but
I went to prison, guys. I got that street cred.
Yeah. Anyways.
Anyways. Okay. So moving quite along to... where we're going next. Okay, so prison escapes. This is where it gets juicy. We want to hear about that.
Yeah.
So on August 12th of 1964, Wilson escaped from Windsor Green Prison in Birmingham in under 3 minutes.
Oh, wow.
That's impressive.
He's a fast boy.
That is fast. I mean,
shut up.
Shut up.
Why?
That's my brain.
I didn't even go there.
I did. I went straight there. Anyways, at this point, we don't need to say it, friends. You know. So the escape being considered unprecedented and that a 3-man team had broken into the prison to extricate him. Extricate him.
Those are some loyal friends to come in and get you out. Like,
that reminds me of, do you remember that? No, you don't. But anyways, do you remember the episode of Charmed where Phoebe goes to prison in the future?
No.
And like their past selves go to the future to get her out of prison and they have to use all these spells to break in and get her out. And then she burns at the stake anyways.
Oh.
Yeah, it was supposed to be like 2009 or some stupid shit. Like, it really wasn't that much in the future. This is the 90s, folks.
But they were still burning witches.
No,
at the
what
state.
Happened is they found this. So, I guess Phoebe killed some baseball player that was beaten on her friend or something and killed her with her magic, or killed him with her magic. And someone caught it on camera, or caught her doing it. And he was like a reporter or something. And so the witch hunt ensued.
Gotcha.
And because of that, they're like, we're going to like revamp the whole burning of the stake thing. And that's what they did. Anyways, but you know, sisters got your back. Mm-hmm. They went and tried to get her out.
His escape team was never caught, and the leader nicknamed Frenchie had disappeared from the London criminal scene by the late 1960s. 2 weeks after his escape, Wilson was in Paris for plastic surgery.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
He's going all in.
I mean, this is...
I mean, I guess you kind of have to.
Yeah, you escape from prison for a train robbery.
Go get you some plastic surgery so no one knows who you are.
So by November of 1965, Wilson was in Mexico City visiting old friends Bruce Reynolds and Buster Edwards. Wilson's escape was yet another dramatic twist in the train robbery saga.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. 11 months after Wilson's escape in July of 1965, Biggs escaped from Wandsworth Prison. 15 months into his sentence, a furniture van was parked alongside the prison walls and a ladder was dropped over the 30-foot-high wall into the prison during outside exercise time, allowing 4 prisoners to escape, including Biggs. The escape was planned by recently released prisoner Paul Seaborn, with the assistance of 2 other ex-convicts, Ronnie Leslie and Ronnie Black, with support from Biggs' wife, Charmaine.
Hmm.
The plot saw 2 other prisoners interfere with the warders and allow Biggs and a friend, Eric Flower, to escape. Seaborn was later caught by Butler and sentenced to 4.5 years. Ronnie Leslie received 3 years for being the getaway driver, and the 2 other prisoners who took advantage of Biggs' escape were captured after 3 weeks. Biggs and Flowers paid a significant sum of money to be smuggled to Paris for plastic surgery.
Hmm.
Biggs said that he had to escape because of the length of the sentence and what he alleged to be the severity of the prison conditions. Okay, so Jimmy White, with the other robbers on the run and having fled the country, only White was at large in the United Kingdom. White was a renowned locksmith and thief and had already been on the run for 10 years before the robbery. He was said to have a remarkable ability to be invisible and to merge with his surroundings and become the ultimate Mr. Nobody. He was a wartime paratrooper and veteran of Arnhem. According to Piers Paul Reed in his 1978 book, The Train Robbers, he was unfortunate in that Brian Field's relatives had dumped luggage containing 100,000 euros only a mile from the site where White had bought a caravan and hidden 30,000 euros in the paneling. In addition, a group of men purporting to be from the flying squad broke into his flat and took a briefcase containing 8,500 euros. Throughout his 3 years on the run with his wife Cherie and baby son Stefan, he was taken advantage of or let down by friends and associates. On April 10th, 1966, a new friend recognized him from photos in a newspaper and informed the police. They arrested him at Little Stone while he was at home. He only had 8,000 euros to hand back to them. The rest was long gone. He was tried in 1966, and Mr. Justice Neal sentenced him to 18 years in jail, which was considerably less than the 30 years given to all the other people. Buster Edwards fled to Mexico with his family to join Bruce Reynolds and later Charlie Wilson, but returned voluntarily to England in 1966, where he was sentenced to 15 years. Charlie Wilson took a residence outside Montreal, Quebec, Canada, on Riguad Mountain, in an upper middle class neighborhood where the large secluded properties are surrounded by trees. He lived under the name Ronald Alloway, a name borrowed from the Fulham shopkeeper. His wife and 3 children soon joined him. He joined an exclusive golf club and participated in the activities of the local community.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was only when he invited his brother-in-law over from the UK for Christmas that Scotland Yard was able to track him down and recapture him.
What a dummy.
Yeah.
You had it going.
Yeah, dude. He was living it up. They waited 3 months before making their move in the hope that Wilson would lead them to Reynolds, the last suspect to still be apprehended. Wilson was arrested on January 25th of 1968 by Tommy Butler. Minnie and Rigaud petitioned that his wife and 3 daughters be allowed to stay in Montreal area. So on June 6th of 1964, Reynolds arrived in Mexico with his wife Angela and son Nick
joining him a few months later after they evaded the obvious police surveillance. A year later, in July of 65, Buster Edwards and his family arrived. Although, unlike the Reynolds family, they planned to return to England at some stage and did not like Mexico. Charlie Wilson, on the run with his family, still back in England, visited them for 6 weeks. So three of the train robbers were together in exile for a time. After the Edwards family returned to England, the Reynoldses also decided to leave Mexico and go to Canada to potentially join up with the Wilson family. Leaving on December 6th of 1966, they had spent so much of their share of the robbery by this point, living far more extravagantly than the Edwardses had. After realizing the danger in settling near the Wilsons in Montreal, they went to live in Vancouver and then went to Nice, France. He went briefly to Torquay, which is where he was captured by Tommy Butler. Ronnie Biggs fled to Paris, which is where he acquired a new identity and new identity papers and underwent plastic surgery. In 1970, he moved to Adelaide, Australia, where he worked as a builder, and he and his wife had a third son. Tipped off that Interpol was showing interest, he moved to Melbourne, working as a set constructor for Channel 9, later escaping to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, after police had discovered his Melbourne address. Biggs could not be extradited because there was no extradition treaty between Britain and Brazil. And additionally, he became father to a Brazilian son, which afforded him legal immunity.
Okay, he found a loophole.
Yeah, he turned out pretty well, I guess. As a result, he lived openly in Rio for many years, safe from the British authorities.
Wow.
In 1981, Biggs' Brazilian son became a member of the successful band, Turma do Balaio Magico. But the band quickly faded into obscurity and dissolved.
Okay.
So, in May 2001, at age 71 and having suffered three strokes, Biggs voluntarily returned to England, accepting that he could be arrested. And his stated desire was to walk into a Margate pub as an Englishman and buy a pint of bitter. Arrested on landing.
Gosh, he didn't even get to get his little bitter, huh?
After detention and a short court hearing, he was sent back to prison to serve the remainder of his sentence. On July 2nd, 2009, Biggs was denied parole by Justice Secretary Jack Straw, who considered Biggs to still be wholly unrepentant.
Okay.
It's not like a fucking 7-year-old man's going to go rob another train. Are you serious?
I know. He does not have that kind of energy.
To me, the whole purpose of being in prison at that point is if you are a menace to society, right?
Yeah.
His crime was robbing a train. It's not like we're talking about murderers or childy diddlers.
I know, but he skipped it. Escaped. He escaped,
yeah,
right?
He did. I'm pretty sure, yeah. Escape. I don't know, whatever. But he was released from custody on August 6th, 2 days before his 80th birthday, on compassionate grounds.
Aww.
Yeah, he died on...
So sweet.
He died on December 18th of 2013 at age 84.
So I guess he got in there that long. Did he get to go get out? I hope he got to go get his little
pint of
bitters.
Hopefully in the end. He had 4 years of freedom.
Yeah.
So, following the deaths of Goody on January 29, 2016, and Tommy Wisby on December 30th, 2016, Bob Welch is the only remaining known member of the gang still alive. In later years, the robbers generally came together for the funerals of their fellow gang members. Wilson's funeral on May 10th of 1990 was attended by Bruce Reynolds, who reported seeing Edwards, Roy James, Welch, and White, who went unnoticed due to his ability to blend into the background.
Mm-hmm.
At Edwards' funeral in 94, Reynolds only saw Welch, Wisby, and James. They were in prison. Brian Field, after being sentenced in 1964, served 4 years of his 5-year sentence and was released in 67. While he was in prison, his wife Karen divorced him and married a German journalist. Karen wrote an article for the German magazine Stern. She confirmed that she took Roy James to a Tyne railway station. I think that's how you say that. So he could go to London, and that she led a convoy of two vans back to her house, where the gang were joined by wives and girlfriends for a big party to celebrate the crime.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's brave.
That is. I mean, I would have celebrated.
I wouldn't have. You know my goody two-shoe ass would have been freaking like, see ya.
He just robbed a train?
I would have been so paranoid. Show me the money. No, I would have been so paranoid.
What? Uh-uh. Throwing up them dollar bills, y'all. Uh-uh. Making a little dollar bill angel in the bed.
And your ass would have been, the FBI would have broken.
I would be the worst criminal in history. The worst criminal ever.
I can't.
Uh-uh. I guess it's a good thing I don't really break the law. Mm-hmm. I mean.
Anyways.
Shut up. She confirmed. Oh, we already confirmed that. When Reynolds returned to the UK in 1968, he tried to contact Field as this was the only way he could get in touch with the Ulstermen. It seems that Field was ambushed upon his release from prison by a recently released convict, Scotch Jack Buggy. Who presumably roughed up or even tortured Field with a view to extorting some of the loot from the robbery. He wanted some money, honey. It's all about them dollar bills. Subsequently, Field went to the ground and Buggy was killed shortly after.
Not Buggy.
Oh, Buggy. Reynolds gave up on trying to find Field. Bummer. So, Field changed his name to Brian Carlton to disappear. That's a very great basic
Brian Carlton.
Name. Brian Carlton. I feel like that's as basic as you get.
Yeah. It's like Brad Smith.
Yeah. Or even John Smith. Sometime after his release from prison, he married Sian from Wales. I don't know. S-I-A-N. It's a girl.
Sian?
Sian. Maybe that's it. Sian.
I don't know.
This is from Wales, so maybe they say things more like they look than in English where nothing makes sense. In the mid to late 70s, they worked for he married this girl. And then they worked for the Children's Book Center in Kensington, High Street, London. Field and his wife, Cyan, we're going to go with that, were responsible for the company's operations in Central and Southern Europe, to where they shipped English language books and held book fairs for international English schools. They did things. So at Field at age 44 and Cyan at age 28 died in a car crash on the M4 motorway on April 27th, 1979.
That's so sad.
Yeah, it was a year after the last of the robbers had completed their sentences.
Mm.
Yeah, they were coming back to visit from her parents. And a Mercedes driven by Amber Besson, who was a pregnant 28-year-old daughter she crossed a damaged section of the guardrail and slammed into their oncoming Porsche.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Amber, her husband, and two children were all instantly killed. It was several weeks after the incident that Field's true identity was discovered. It was not clear whether his wife ever knew of his past.
That's so sad.
That is really sad, actually. Charlie Wilson, the last of the robbers released after serving one-third of his sentence, Wilson returned to the life of crime and was found shot dead at his villa in Marbella, Spain on April 24th of 1990. So just 2 days. No, I'm not going to put my birthday in here. I shouldn't put my birthday on here, should I?
I mean, I put a birthday post on the Instagram.
Oh, that's right. So yeah, my birthday is April 22nd. This happened 2 days after I was born. His murder was thought to be related to suspect cheating and drug dealing.
Oh.
Or suspected to cheating and drug dealing.
Okay.
I don't know. He was cheating and drug dealing. He was, you know.
Doing things.
That's bad. Buster Edwards was released and he became a flower seller outside of Waterloo Station.
Aww.
That sounds cute. His story was dramatized in the 1988 film Buster with Phil Collins in the title role. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, this fella died in his garage, committing suicide. Hanging himself.
Oh, no.
But his family continued to run the flower stall after his death.
That's so tragic.
Yeah, it is tragic. That's actually probably the saddest one, I think. I don't know. The other one was sad, too. Roy James went back to motor racing. following his release in August of 75. However, he crashed several cars.
Okay, Charles. Sorry.
And his chances of becoming a driver quickly faded. After the failure of his sporting career, he returned to his trade as a silversmith. He produced the trophy given to... So sad.
What?
So, okay. His racing career failed. Uh-huh. So he went back to his trade as a silversmith, right?
Right.
Which he then produced the trophy given to Formula One promoters each year. Thanks.
So, like, his dream. He's having to give other people trophies.
It's like one of those, if you can't teach it. If you can't race, make the trophies for all the other ones.
If you can. At least he got to, like, hold them in his hand and, like, you know.
I guarantee you. And he made his, like,
he had, like, yes! A little podium with, like, first place on
first
it.
First place, bitches. This is why we need to do videos.
Poor fella.
Oh, I know. Poor dude. Well, I mean, at least he didn't kill himself or die in a car crash. But
that doesn't sound good.
So by 1983, James and Charlie Wilson had become involved in an attempt to import gold without paying excise duty, whatever that is. James was acquitted in January for his part in the swindle. And in 1993, he shot and wounded his father-in-law. Pistol whipped and partially strangled his ex-wife.
What?
After they had returned, after they had returned their children for a day's outing.
What the hell?
So he was sentenced to 6 years in jail.
Just 6 years for that. Okay.
30 years for robbing the train. Six years for trying to kill your wife and your brother-in-law, father-in-law. Oh, shit. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Why?
I don't know. James underwent a triple bypass surgery and was subsequently released from prison in 97, only to die almost immediately afterwards on August 21st after another heart attack. He was the fifth member of the gang to die despite being the youngest.
Damn.
Yeah. So Roger Cordry was the first of the robbers released, but his share of the theft had almost been completely recovered by the police.
That sucks.
Yeah, that sucks.
It was probably one of the dodos that just left it sitting there. You know how they just found bags of it just
randomly.
Yeah.
He went back to being a florist at his sister's business upon release. That's interesting.
Okay.
Interesting. He's now dead. But his son, Tony, has publicly acknowledged that his dad confirmed that Bill Bowl was innocent of any involvement in the robbery. Mm. Bruce Reynolds, the last of the robbers to be caught, was released from prison in 78 after serving 10 years. Reynolds, then aged 47, was helped by Gordon Goody to get back on his feet before Goody departed for Spain. By 1978, day release ended and reported to a parole officer. Frank Monroe, one of the three robbers who was never caught, temporarily gave Reynolds a job but did not want to attract undue attention by employing him for too long. Reynolds later got back together with his wife, Angela, and son, Nicholas, and was arrested in 1983 for drug-related offenses, although he denied having any involvement. He was released again in 1985 and dedicated himself to helping his wife recover from a mental breakdown.
Same.
In 2001, he and his son Nicholas traveled with reporters from the Sun newspaper to take Biggs back to Britain. In 2010, he wrote the afterword for Signal Red, Robert Ryan's novel based on the robbery. And he regularly commented on the robbery. He died in his sleep at age 81 in 2013.
So what we can take away from all of this is... don't rob a train because your life is going to suck afterwards.
Yep.
It's not worth it.
You're going to get karma.
I feel like none of them had luck after that.
Mm-mm. Definitely not. Definitely not.
But at least he died peacefully in his sleep.
Yeah. So I have one more of these. John Daly, upon his acquittal and release, after finding his share of loot stolen and or destroyed.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he gave up his life a crime and went straight. He and his wife, Barbara, and their three children moved to Cornwall, where he worked as a street sweeper until the age of 70. Aww. Known to the locals as Gentle John or John the Gent. Daly told no one about the robbery, as he was told he could face a retrial. He died 6 weeks after his brother-in-law, Reynolds. Okay. So recovery of the money. So as we remember, there was a shit ton stolen, like $12 million in today's money. The bulk of the haul was in, we already know, 1 and 5 euro notes. So that with the exception of a few drinks for associates, so I guess they just went and had a celebratory drink with the money. And then after that, the loot was split into 17 equal shares of around 150 euros each of that time.
Mm-hmm.
So like probably, you know, a couple million today. Although someone claims that there was 18 shares. I don't know, 17, 18. With a few notable exceptions, the money was quickly laundered or divided by friends, family, and associates of the robbers. Much was laundered through bookmakers. Wilson and Wisby were the bookmakers. Although astonishingly, only a few hundred pounds were identifiable by serial numbers, so the robbers could have spent the money without fear of being traced. There were 1,579 notes whose serial numbers were known, and the rest of the money was completely untraceable.
So most of the money, who knows?
Yeah.
Like, they don't really know.
Okay, so although within 6 months of the robbery, 10 of the robbers had been locked up and were awaiting trial, 3 others were wanted criminals on the run, and very little of the money had actually been recovered. This led to speculation that there was a great deal of robbery loot still out there. In fact, the money was soon seized and spent by predatory gangsters and greedy associates, relatives, and lawyers.
Oh, no.
Lawyers.
Oh, my.
Thus, the proceeds of the greatest cash robbery in the British history were quickly used up, with few of the robbers actually receiving any of the money or any long-term benefit of this robbery.
So
I feel like that's the biggest thing to take from all of this is you're going to go to jail, your life's going to suck, and you ain't going to get none of the money anyways because someone's going to take it. This is a terrible idea.
It was. They had it going at the very beginning. The ending just kind of...
It just fell completely apart. Like, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the story of the greatest train robbery heist in British history, friends.
That was a good story, Brittany. Thank you.
It's a little interesting. I'm sorry I kind of... Okay, so are you ready to tell us your little spooky, spooky story of the week?
Sure.
Let's go. Let's hear it.
So this is of the Harvard Exit Theater. My sources are thehauntedhouses.com and my BFF, Wikipedia.
I love that you're going along with the theater theme. Keep it going.
Yeah.
Wait, what theater is this?
So the Harvard Exit Theater, and it's not at Harvard, so don't.
No, right, but yeah. Harvard's a place, right? And there's just a college in a place?
I
don't know.
I don't either.
I don't really actually know that.
I don't think this has to do with Harvard at all.
Oh, so it's just what it's called?
Yeah. Okay, so it is a 3-story brick building that was built in 1925 on the site of another house that had once existed on the same spot.
Okay.
So the first floor main lobby is described as being grand and glorious, full of 1920 ambiance. It had a grand piano and a very big chandelier when you walked in. Mm-hmm. It had some cute little comfortable chairs with some tables and lamps that were grouped by the huge fireplace. Mm-hmm. So you could just go sit and be cozy.
That's fun. Mm-hmm. I like that.
And it was always lit for patrons to watch and enjoy while waiting at the entrance to the theater on the first floor. So the first floor theater is the main theater, and that one has like a big balcony in it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the second floor is used for administrative purposes with offices that were for the employees of the theater. And there is a main hall on the second floor that runs through the area with various rooms off of this hall. The third floor holds the new theater that was put in during the 1980s when a second auditorium was added in an unused ballroom space on this third floor of the building. Mm-hmm. The lobby of this theater also has a cute little fireplace that's always lit for people to go be cozy by.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 1920s, Harvard Exit House became the home of the Women's Century Club for many years, whose focused members were dedicated to getting the right to vote and equality for women. So
excellent.
It's a good place.
Yeah.
Yeah. From the early days of the Women's Century Club, some women members lived in the building on the second floor and in the apartment on the third floor through the 1970s. The Women's Century Club still meets in the building twice a week, though it is now known as a theater house.
Mm-hmm.
It opened up as a cinema in 1968 and was run by people described as eccentric film buffs. Or as more of a wild bunch of hippie types. I don't know.
Sounds like they're talking about my kind of people.
which this was in 1968. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it was that time.
Oh, you damn hippie.
Yeah. And that was an opinion that the theater manager, Alan Blangie, had at that time. The Landmark Theater chain took over the operations in 1979 and put in another cinema on the third floor during the early 1980s. Today, the theater specializes in art films, both foreign and American classic movies, and is the site of film festivals such as the Seattle International Film Festival.
Okay.
In 2014, the club was sold to developer Eagle Rock Ventures after getting approval for their plans from the Harvard-Belmont Historic District folks. The designs by the developer SHW Architects and Dovetail General Contractors were approved, and their adaptive reuse renovation was begun in 2015. What do we know about renovations?
That stirs shit up.
Some spooky shit.
I don't like it.
So this is in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I guess I didn't mention that. So the Seattle Consulate of Mexico then, that's what it became, and it opened its doors in July of 2018.
Okay.
So we're going to get to the spooky shit. So hauntings of this building go back to the very beginning. There are several facts of incidents that happened within the Harvard exit that give explanations for the paranormal activities. So nearly every decade through the 80s contributed something to the paranormal activity. So on the first floor, around the turn of century, a murder of a man killed in a bra took place in the house that
Killed in a bra?
Like a fight?
A brawl.
Shut up.
I thought... I was like...
Sorry. What? He got killed in a bra, okay? Sorry. I don't know how to speak English. In a brawl.
Clearly I can't either.
In a brawl.
A brawl. Okay.
But he was killed in the house that was torn down before it became... The theater building.
That place.
So a male manifestation described as being portly, slightly see-through, and wearing an old-fashioned suit has made his appearance known. He calls himself Peter and is described as a very light-hearted fella, kind of goofy.
Okay.
So he's a goofy little ghost.
Goofy little.
That died in a bra.
Fella.
Hey, could you imagine their own, okay?
This little fella walk. Like, when I picture this, I think of, like, kind of like Professor Slughorn, you know?
Uh-huh.
That's what I kind of picture, but in a bra. Yeah. I mean, if he wants to wear a bra, it's cool. I was just like, why did he die in a bra?
Sorry.
I mean, I would hate to die in a bra.
I mean, I like my tits to be where they're supposed to be, so I like bras.
I hate bras.
Anyways, I'm sorry. So psychic investigators Jane Reese and J.R. Benight, producers of TV talk show Seattle in Vogue, were watching a film in the main theater auditorium. Jane felt an invisible presence playfully toying with her hair over her neck. No, thank you. Out of the corner of her eye, she spied a flicker of light down in front of the auditorium just right by the screen. And it was, like, right next to the exit door.
Mm-hmm.
She then saw a translucent form of a portly gentleman in profile with distinguished demeanor watching the film on screen just enjoying himself.
Mm.
The same psychic investigators, through a channeling medium, talked to another male spirit with a British-like accent, but no name was given. This suggests that perhaps Peter has a fellow male spirit to do some ghostly male bonding within the main theater, perhaps helping themselves to free showings and playing with women's hair and, you know, just doing things
to people and creeping them out.
Yeah.
Creepers.
On other occasions, one or both of these ghostly film enthusiasts have been known to reorganize the film canisters around the projection rooms. Hmm. On several occasions during the years, theater managers have opened the building and found the movie projector showing a film to an unseen audience. In one instance, a projectionist arrived to start his shift and found that a movie had already been playing to an empty, dark house. He went up to the projection room to catch the guilty party, but found that the door was locked from the inside.
Ew.
They're like, no, we're not done with our movie. Go away.
Yeah, go away. We're watching this.
So Peter and his unknown male spirit friend enjoy films, but also other unseen guests, perhaps a female apparition spotted in the balcony, also appreciates the cinematic arts.
Oh, okay.
So in 1940s, a woman was suffocated somewhere in the building.
Oh.
She could be the entity that was in the balcony, and perhaps the same entity that can be seen scaring the administrative personnel on the second floor. So in the balcony of the first floor theater, a female entity has been felt and seen there. A janitor who was vacuuming the rug suddenly got the sense that she wasn't alone in the auditorium. After turning off her vacuum cleaner, she glanced up to the balcony and saw a figure wearing an old-fashioned dress, maybe Victorian. She was just standing there, though she couldn't make out the face or hands. Another young woman at a different time saw the same apparition in more complete form, also standing in the same balcony. They think it might be a part of the Women's Century Club, like I had mentioned, mm-hmm. when they lived there through the 1970s.
Right.
So the first floor lobby, two different female entities and their friends have been seen there, in person and in photos taken of the empty room. Theater manager Janet Wainwright, who was the theater manager for 10 years, in charge of opening up the theater, met these spirits and felt that they were positive and helpful. On one of her first days on the job, Janet walked into the lobby and was startled to see a woman sitting in a chair near the fireplace, just reading a book.
Oh.
The woman was described as having her hair in a bun on top of her head, wearing a long floral dress, and was just slightly see-through. Much to her fascination and horror, the woman slowly melted into thin air.
Oh, that's strange.
Whenever people say that they see apparitions and stuff and it just like slowly like fades away or in this case melts, like I don't know what that looks like, obviously. Yeah. Like how does something just melt away?
Yeah, that's strange.
Anyways. At other meetings in the lobby, this female entity would look up at Janet or any human being standing there, smile pleasantly, turn off the lamp, and walk out of the room. It's a tradition to have the fire burning in the first floor fireplace for the enjoyment of the people that are waiting to go into the auditorium. This is the responsibility of the duty of the evening theater manager. This was the first job Janet did upon arriving. Every once in a while, the fire was already burning brightly before Janet had arrived. A spirit had helped with the chores. So these are good ones. On these occasions, the chairs had been moved around the fire as if people had been chatting, enjoying the company. The chairs had always been moved back to their places before closing the theater doors the night before. Sometimes Janet didn't have to enter the darkened lobby to light the fire because she would see a tall female entity leave the lobby, switching on the lights as she left the room on both the first floor and the third floor. So at least they're like helping.
Yeah.
All right. It is thought that this tall entity could be the spirit of Bertha Landis, a strong president of the Women's Century Club and the City Federation of Women's Clubs, who was also Seattle's first mayor.
Oh, okay.
She seems to like to help out the theater managers and also keep an eye on the place. Psychic research through a channeling medium, like I said, Jane Reese and J.R. Benight were able to talk to a stern older woman, who could be Bertha, who wanted to know in no uncertain terms that Janet and J.R. were up to her in her place.
Mm-hmm.
After acknowledging that she and the other ghosts knew that they were dead, she had a hissy fit when it was suggested that she needed to move on because she no longer belonged here. We like it here. This is our home. You wouldn't want to leave your home in the middle of the night, and neither do we. That's what she responded to the medium.
Well, all right. Yeah. She's got a point.
Yeah. So the second floor. So, like I mentioned before, in the first floor theater, a woman was suffocated in the building in the 1940s. A medium named Sylvia Brown described this apparition as being a short woman, an actress that was dressed in Victorian period long dress, who, like I said, was suffocated, meeting a violent end, which often creates a restless, unhappy spirit.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
Although the hauntings mainly occur on the first and third floor, a female apparition, a sad, forlorn soul, has appeared several times to various people working in the administrative offices. She likes to scare them. Mm-hmm. When she isn't getting her kicks upsetting the folks on the second floor, an apparition of her description has been seen on the balcony of the first floor. On one occasion, a man working in the second floor administrative office suddenly heard a woman crying as if her heart was breaking. Aww. Going out in the hall, he saw a female in emotional distress. Thinking that she was real, he approached her to offer her comfort. Then she just vanished into thin air.
Well, that's a creepy thing to happen.
That's a trip.
Yeah.
Several other women working in these offices throughout the years have also seen this full-formed female floating down the hallway, causing them to flee as fast as possible down to the main floor. So we're going to get to the third floor. So the spirit of Bertha Landis enjoys appearing briefly to the living in the third floor lobby, as well as the first floor lobby. She is the most common apparition spotted by the living and doesn't plan to leave anytime soon, like we talked about. The third floor is the favorite place where they call a thought form. It's strongly felt and makes its home with the purpose of watching out over the building. It is described by Jane Rees and J.R. Benight as an entity formed by mass energy, often from negative sources. It has no personality, just a collective will that is often arrogant, dictatorial in nature. Jane Rees and J.R. Benight contacted this thought form through a medium and came to the following conclusion. This thought form was molded over many years from several sources. So a group of strong, intense, passionate suffragettes called the Harvard Exit Building their home base for many years. In the late 1960s, early 1970s, drug parties took place in the building. Two other activities stirred up this entity, seances and spirit communication classes, and the renovation of the third floor. On the third floor during the 70s decade, a woman would hold classes in contacting the spirits and would lead seances. When the theater changed hands, being bought by the Landmark in 1979, a new auditorium was added to the third floor. So building renovation projects often, of course, stir up entities and forces, experiences with this thought form.
Okay.
It's just like this little cloud of thought.
Ether bubble thing.
So Alan Blangy, a man not easily scared and a bit of a skeptic concerning ghosts, became the theater manager after Janet Wainwright's tenure. He had an uneasy sense that something in the building was hostile to him. This something made itself known one evening when Blangy and his assistant manager were in the process of locking up the theater for the night. Suddenly, he heard a loud bang. So he quickly went back inside. He heard people talking in the third floor lobby. So he went up to investigate. While no one was there, he did hear the side exit door open and close. He went over to be sure that the door had closed tightly. It had not. Someone or something on the other side was pulling against him, stopping him from shutting the door.
Oh.
He finally did so, but opened the door again with his assistant by his side, so he had support in confronting these strange people. Both men opened the door, but 5 seconds later, they found that no one was there. The third floor metal fireplace escape would have made a lot of noise if anyone had gone down that. After this experience, he no longer felt this hostility, but instead felt welcomed. He had passed the test. This was his initiation.
Oh, I see.
One can conclude that while this thought form may be bossy in nature, it can change its opinion, which sounds like the main energy of this thought form can be controlled by the passionate energy mass, whose main purpose is to watch over the building. A group of psychics and parapsychologists spent time at night hanging out in the theater. Some put a magnet by the exit door. They witnessed over a period of weeks a large ball of energy which would appear and move across the auditorium and out the exit door, causing the magnet to revolve wildly.
Interesting.
And that is the story of the Harvard Exit Theater.
Well, cool beans. That was a hiccup, I'm sorry.
So we're going to let Sophie tell her story.
Excellent. All right, Sophie, what you got for us this week?
The Dark Watchers.
The Dark Watchers. How interesting.
Yes. The Dark Watchers is a name given to a group of entities in California folklore, supposedly seen by travelers along the Santa Lucia Mountains.
Okay.
They've been also spotted in some areas of Wisconsin and Illinois, such as Milwaukee.
Okay.
And police reports have been made in the town of Kenosha, but were also suspended since no actual proof was provided.
Gotcha.
The Dark Watchers are described as tall, sometimes giant-sized, featureless dark silhouettes, often adorned with brimmed hats or walking sticks.
Okay.
They're often reported to be seen in the hours around twilight and dawn. They are said to watch travelers from the horizon along Santa Lucia mountain range. According to the legend, no one has seen one up close, and if someone were to approach them, they disappear. While someone attributed to the Chumash people who historically inhabited the central and southern coastal regions of California, Pepe looks suspiciously back every minute or so, and his eyes sought to the tops of the ridges ahead. Once in a while, on a white-burned spur, he saw a black figure for a moment, but he looked quickly away, for it was one of the Dark Watchers. No one knew who the Watchers were, nor where they lived, but it was better to ignore them and never show any interest in them. They did not bother one who stayed on the trail and minded his own business. According to newspaper archives, in the mid-1960s, a Montanari Peninsula local and former high school principal went on a hiking trip in the Santa Lucias when he suddenly spot a dark figure standing on a rocks and surveying the area. When the principal called out to the other hikers, the creature vanished. Illusions, hallucinations, or misinterpretation of natural stimulus brought on by exhaustion or insulation have been proposed by psychologists. Infrasound, which can be generated by wind, can cause feelings of uneasiness and anxiety in some people and frequently connected to the paranormal sightings.
Oh.
That's like what they're saying right now is they're just explaining like right. what it could be, you know?
Right.
An optical illusion, also known as broken spectre, is a plausible explanation for the legend. A broken spectre, mountain spectre, can occur in certain atmospheric conditions when the sun is at a particular angle. The subject's shadow can be cast onto a cloud bank around them, creating the illusion of a large shadowy humanoid figure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like an explanation of like what it could be.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Well, that is all I have for the Dark Watchers.
All right. Well, that was a very interesting story. Thank you so kindly for sharing with us.
The information is brought to us by the Wikipedia.
By Wikipedia.
By Wikipedia.
Our best friend.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Sophie. We'll see you next week.
All right.
Thank you, Sophie, for that story.
Yeah, that was excellent.
If you have 5 seconds today while you're listening to this, will you please go leave us a review on Apple Podcast?
It'd be excellent.
5 stars, please. Five. Very nice. Very kind to us. We would really appreciate it. And if you would like to follow our Instagram, it is at Literally Disturbed Podcast. And if you would like to follow our Twitter, it's at Literally DPod. And if you have a true crime or paranormal story that you would like to send in, you can send that to our email at literallydisturbedpodcast@gmail.com.
Yep, yep.
And if you would like to support our podcast and pay $5 make you holla.
Yeah,
it make
us holla. You know.
you can go to our Patreon. It is at patreon.com/literallydisturbed. Or if you don't feel like doing that, you can just go onto our Instagram and go into our link tree in the bio, and it is all on there. We thank you so much for listening and your support, and we appreciate you and
each and everyone.
Yep. Bye.
Just for the way you are.
Yeah.
Okay, really.
Thank you. Bye.